in the audience at the moment. You guys have a little bit longer to stay and play. All right, so the basic idea that I want to tell you about today is the application, a sort of growing interest in the application of gauge gravity duality to non-relativistic conformal field theories. So this is sort of an extension, we agreed to which an extension rather than a special case of ADS-CFT remains somewhat to be seen, but that's the basic idea. And my goal is to build a strong coupling description of non-relativistic conformal field theories that can be built in laboratory. That's the long-term goal. We can't do that yet. Not even close. But that's the idea. The reason this is something worth doing is because the gauge gravity duality we know we can apply to useful systems are applied to systems like QCD, where you have to build RIC, and RIC is big and expensive, and it's one experiment. There are tons of non-relativistic conformal field theories out there that people build and study. There are lots and lots of critical points and lots of condensed matter systems. And so there are a lot of systems where you have experimental data for a strong coupling conformal system that they can build on the tabletop. I'll talk about a couple in some detail in a minute, where a strong coupling description just doesn't exist, not even close. So that's the reason that you might start thinking about this kind of thing. I'm not going to be able to do anything like that. But I want to start talking about, I want to give you a sense for what where this part of the field is right now. And that's sort of the motivation, that's where we'd like. So let me tell you some of the takeaway lessons that I hope I convince you of by the end of today. So first, first is that we can apply, oops, that's my name. We can apply gauge gravity duality to non-relativistic conformal field theories. And I'll define for you what I mean by non-relativistic conformal field theory. But it's basically what you expect. It's a conformal field theory where the constituents are non-relativistic, where the dispersion relation is non-relativistic. I want to, in particular, argue that a non-relativistic conformal field theory, so first off, non-relativistic conformal group is labeled by a parameter z, which we'll study in some detail in a few minutes, but that a non-relativistic conformal field theory, in the same sense that a relativistic conformal field theory is dual to an ABS space, is dual to something that's called the Schrödinger space, where we know what the geometry of this space is. Okay, this is generalizing ADS to relativistic CFT. In particular, in this map, just like in any conformal field theory, you can organize conformal field theory in terms of the chiral primaries. In ADS CFT, we're familiar that the chiral primaries come with a dimension. In the non-relativistic case, they come with a dimension and one other. There are actually two parameters, a dimension and something called, conventionally called L, which is the eigenvalue of something called the number operator. So for example, in systems where you're non-relativistic usually means you have some mass. That means the fundamental constituent comes in chunks, and the number is just effectively the number of chunks. So if you have a bunch of fermions, non-relativistic massive fermions, the number operator is just the fermion number operator. And in general, it'll have some eigenvalues, and that's called L. We'll go into this in some detail. But the important thing here is that instead of having one parameter labeling the states, like dimension, we have two. Now, in ADS-CFT, the dimension is something that becomes the eigenvalue of the radial direction. The holographic dimension is the thing that controls scale. Dilatation is the thing that tells you how an operator, or the dimension is the thing that tells you how the operator scales under a conformal scaling. And so the radial dimension, the dimension itself, is the eigenvalue under something like DDR. It corresponds to, I should say more directly, to a radial direction. In the same way, the second parameter is going to correspond to a new direction, a new holographic direction in the gravity dual of a non-relativistic theory. So we're now going to have holography with two extra dimensions rather than just one. It's an important difference from the relativistic case, and it leads to a lot of sort of technical subtleties that I'll touch on. So there are two holographic directions. these are the same as ABS-CFT, and this is markedly different. So these are just things that I want to convince you of. But again, right now I'm not explaining what I mean. There are lots of examples. And I'll build a bunch for you. And this comes along with an existence proof for small deformations, for perturbation theory. So if we tweak the, if we have a solution or if we have an example of one of these dwellings and we tweak the system in some suitably minimal way, we get a generalization. This is work with Ananda and San Vasquez and Nalpolin. And finally, we can even start studying quantity effects or 1 over n effects. And they turn out to be tractable, at least somewhat tractable enough to start saying interesting things, and qualitatively similar to the kinds of quantum effects in known examples, in known Riemann's matter examples, which is really delightful. This is the desiderata. This is what I'd like all of you to walk out feeling convinced of. I will have failed if that's not true. So that's my job. Wow. How much of that can you see? Can you see it all? Yeah, okay. So I should say before I go on that this is based on work 0807 dot numbers with Koshy Balasubramanian and John McGreevy, both at MIT. Koshik is John's student, and 0812 something with Ananda Sinha and San Vasquez. And then Alex Maloney, so he's out of order. But you're not upset. As well as work in progress with various linear combinations of this group and various students at MIT. Okay, so before we get going, questions on the broad picture? So that's the basic gig. So,
could I ask a naive question? So do you think it's realistic to construct a large model in labs?
No, I don't. I also don't think it's realistic to construct a large end model at RIC. So what we're going to be doing at the end of the day is one of two things. Either we're in the same way that in ADS-QCD, we're either going to argue something out of universality. I have a conformal field theory. It is not the same conformal field theory as the one that I'm interested in, you know, the fixed point and asymptotic regime and quark scattering or whatever. It's not the same conformal field theory. It's not even the same massive field theory, but it's similar in some qualitative features. So I may not get numbers out that are, you know, predicted, but if it's in the same sort of general universality class and I wave my hand enough, the phase diagrams that I get out at the end of the day might look similar. That might be useful and suggestive. The second thing is, okay, one of the things we've learned from ADS-QCD is that the gravity is much more important in some senses than the specific gravity theory. Right? The fact that you work with supergravity and or type 2D string theory or whatever is not necessarily the germane feature. People build toy models where they just arbitrarily truncate on both sides, and they do surprising things, right? We've learned things about rho dominance and, you know, other silly facts of nuclear physics that are very sort of non-trivial that you get out of toy models. And we don't have an a priori derivation, but it's a good way to start making progress in a strong coupling expansion. So the hope is to use one of those either just toys or universality rather than to try to nail large n. That said, there are descriptions like a system I'm about to tell you a little bit about, where there are theoretical descriptions for a system that exists in the lab, and there are large n models of this, and there's some understanding of what happens as you go from large to small n. So if you could match on the large n description there, that would also be progress, right? Yeah?
Okay, jumping ahead, but in the gravity dual, for gravity, you can go into a quantum field and have that on
Yes.
approximation.
Yes.
And in that, you can have a calculation of particles that go in the x tonomorphic photographic direction that corresponds to the quantum number L,
yes.
The opposite momentum.
Yes. Yeah, curvature. Right.
What would that correspond in the dual non-relativistic thing?
Okay, this is going to be an important question. Let me come back to it when I talk about the relation to the dual field theory. And that'll be an important thing to think about. But let me come back to it. Okay, because I'm not going to be able to answer it without explaining what I'm doing first. Yeah.
Are there any interesting limits in these non-relativistic CFTs besides just large n? I mean, an ABS CFT, large n is the obvious thing.
Right. It's a fantastic question. I don't know the answer. I can tell you a couple of things about it. There are analogs. So take a non-relativistic CFT at zero chemical potential. What's the physics? There is no physics. It's a non-relativistic free particle. You need to be at finite density for the physics to be interesting. So finite density effects are crucial. Right? The reason for this is pretty straightforward. Say I have a relativistic theory and I study 2-to-2 scattering. Right? It's total chaos. So two particles go in, hell breaks loose, two particles come out. Right? But in a non-relativistic theory, the physics is much, much more simple. Yeah. The physics is a lot easier to understand and describe. And the reason is this: there are no antiparticles, right? This is what you were just alluding to. So there are no antiparticles. So every 2-to-2 scattering diagram looks like this. So you never have particles going the other way. You never have antiparticles. So the diagrammatic simplified tremendously. So unless I start introducing, you know, some additional density, a single particle, the physics is very easy to describe. Or for a zero density particle. There's nothing that can happen. So there are interesting limits where you look at large densities, but that's just like any conformal field theory. You know, when you start turning on chemical potentials, then the physics changes and often it gets more interesting. Beyond that, as I'll try to emphasize in a little bit, there's some confusion about even, so given a geometry of the kind I'm about to tell you, there's some confusion about what exactly is the dual field theory. There's sort of a Z2 at work that we don't understand. And before we can start answering questions like your question, which is very reasonable and important, we still have the even lowest order question of what is the dual field theory. There's still confusion about that. So this is very early in this sort of exploration of this branch. Does that answer your question?
Sure. What if it's true of non-relativistic Galilean
invariant? Yeah.
A non-Galilean invariant theory would have much richer.
Absolutely. So let me say that for the most part today, I'm going to be talking, when I say non-relativistic, I mean something very specific. I mean things that have dispersion relation maybe goes like k-splitter, not omega squared goes like k-4. Okay, so these two are very different beasts. This theory has antiparticles, this one doesn't.
Boost invariant.
Yeah. Galois boost invariant. Yeah, that's right. So that's going to be crucial for that's exactly right. Okay, any other questions before we go on? Okay. So, so there's this very beautiful experiment that a guy down the hall from us does, Martin Zwirlein. Many people do this, but he does it particularly beautifully. If you take lithium atoms and you cool them down very, very cold, microkelvin, a small population of lithium atoms are fermions, they're nuclear spin. And when they collide, they have a repulsive interaction in their ground state. But there is a hyperfine splitting in the lithium system. So that despite the fact that, so here's the inner atomic potential, you have some particle, it's free, it's repulsed, and out it goes. There's a hyperfine splitting in the lithium system, so that if you turn on some magnetic field, there's an excited state. And the excited state is at some energy above this, and the potential looks like this. This leads to a very beautiful effect called the Feshbach resonance, which is very simple. Imagine I'm in the excited state, and I have the energy of an unbound lithium atom. Okay? If one of the atoms is in the excited state, this is excited, this is ground, then it's bound. Right? So there's a bound state if one of the lithium atoms is excited. But if they're both in the ground state, it's free. Okay? So this leads to an interesting process. If you have a bunch of low energy, very slow ground state lithium atoms, and they collide, that collision can excite one of them into the ground state, or into the excited state, and then they're stuck. and they're stuck until it spontaneously emits a photon, and apart they go. Okay? So there's this enhancement of the cross-section for collision, because they're not just colliding, but they're sticking together anomalously long. Now, this splitting, you can tune with the B field. It's a hyperfine. It's a hyperfine splitting. So you can tune the splitting to be the same as energy, just the thermal energy, kinetic energy, of a typical lithium particle. What that means is you've got a threshold bound state. Right? And when a bound state appears or disappears at threshold, the scattering length diverges. So the scattering length in the system for a critical value of the B field, the scattering length goes to infinity from either the plus or the minus side. Now here's the cool thing about this system. You've got a bunch of lithium atoms, and you can make the scattering length much larger than the typical interparticle separation. Okay, so the scattering length is much larger than the mean free path between collisions. So in that system, there's no scale. So this is a conformal system. Indeed, the scattering length is diverse. So this is a conformal theory, but the constituents in this theory are lithium atoms, and they're heavy. You don't pair create lithium atoms. Right? You only have lithium atoms, not anti-lithium atoms. So it's non-relativistic. Okay, so this is a non-relativistic conformal field theory, and it's strongly interact, sort of inescapably, right? The cross-section is much larger than the size, than the spacing between the particles. Very strong, it's constant interaction between the particles. So by tuning the B field, effectively, or the splitting, Martin can tune this from a BCS phase to a BEC phase. And then there's a crossover point where it's a critical system. And the scattering at this in this regime with the infinite scattering length saturates the unitarity bound, so it's called fermions, because these are fermionic lithium atoms. Fermions at unitarity. Okay. So this is a very famous system in the kinetic matter world for lots of reasons. But this is an example of a kind of system where we don't have a description, we don't have a good computationally effective theoretical description. What you do when you want to analyze it is you work in some epsilon expansion, you build a toy model with some large n, or you do some statistical description, Boltzmann models. Yeah?
Why do you say it's really happening? It's conformal. Why? What is the happening? What do you mean by?
Good. If you think of this as a bunch of independent electrons, or sorry, as a bunch of independent fermions, then you can ask, well, what do you have to do? What's the effective interaction as you start tuning the B field closer and closer to the critical value? And the coupling is getting order one.
But you're not using parameter which are not, you're not tuning the parameter in the field which is conformal for any parameter.
This is true, but okay, so I'm gonna.
So this may assume some other theory in which the coupling flows to some value.
Yeah, let me make a sort of sharper statement. So here's the zero temperature limit. So suppose we could really do the zero temperature regime. Okay. And here's some parameter that we're tuning. Let's say B. There's some critical value. B critical. If you tell them finite temperature, this critical field theory, this conformal field theory, just becomes a conformal field theory at finite temperature. But of course, if you move away from the critical point, then it's no longer conformal. You've introduced a gap by tuning away from, right? And the gap is essentially determined by the scattering. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the gap that's induced, if delta, the gap induced by being away from B critical, is less than the effect of the scale induced by temperature, then this point, it's true that we're away from the critical, but the more salient feature is that you've broken scale invariance by a finite temperature. It's a much larger effect. So this point, even though it's not critical, is well described by the conformal field theory at finite temperature. Okay. So it's well described by the conformal field theory at finite temperature. Okay, so that's fine. So you've got a whole sort of pizza wedge, right, of region where you're effectively controlled by the conformal field theory at finite temperature. But you can also ask, as you're getting from the edge of this pizza wedge into the truly critical point, there's a coupling that you can ask in terms of the fundamental fermions, is it getting stronger? What's happening to the coupling that's getting strong?
Suppose you were considering a relativistic conformal field in which you understand. On the same line of thought, you would say that it's only coupled, even though
Oh, okay. So, so let me phrase this question differently. What's the analog of lambda in this system? And there is no, so in this system, we don't have a large n limit. We just have g, we just have the single coupling, which is effectively the scattering. So in this system, there's.
So much field theory is scattered in this field.
Yes.
So what's the forward field theory in field, but it's mystically not understood.
Yes.
This parameter is in theory.
Yes.
But still, we can talk about field coupling and
quantum. Yes, those are very special theories. This is not one of those theories. Right, it's a very special fact about large n equals 4 that we have.
Mean in saying conformal and saying splenic coupling is the same thing.
It doesn't have to be, but it is in this case.
I guess he's complaining that you didn't give an independent reason why this system would be splenic coupling. So it's conformal, but it might be trivial.
Right. Okay, good. So good. So in fact, there are two theories that have this symmetry structure, one of which doesn't have a small coupling, small parameter, and one of which is free. So there is indeed a free and an interacting theory at the critical fixed point. You know, you can flow from one to the other by turning on a relevant deformation. But let me make the weakest possible statement here, because it's all that's necessary. There's no small coupling parameter. There's no small parameter that I can use to make an expansion in perturbation theory. There's no weak coupling description. If you try to describe it in terms of weakly interacting fermions, there's just no description of this in terms of weakly interacting fermions. They're constantly scattering in terms of the fermion picture.
What does it mean? It's impossible to write a Lagrange with a potential property. So what does it mean?
No, okay, so let me give you an example of a description of this. It's a useful computational description, the Hubbard model. The Hubbard model is a good toy model of this. Okay, and if you study the Hubbard model in the limit that gives you the fermions of unitarity, you're taking it to an order one coupling description. Now, that's not a field theory that we wanted to start with, but you know, it's an effective description.
There is a difference between automatic field theory and conformal perturbation theory.
Absolutely.
So
okay, let me block this off because it's not germane to the rest of what I'm going to do. And we can come back to it afterwards. Okay. So it'll be much more, well, this question does not arise in the kind of models we can describe at the moment. So let me for discussion. So okay. So something we'd like would be to have a description of this kind of a system. So if this is conformal and it's non-relativistic, what's the non-relativistic conformal group? Right? What is this non-relativistic conformal group, which is the symmetry of the interaction in the theory? So let me give you an example. So the Lagrangian for the fermions in this system, a canonical description is in terms of a Dagger dt. Oops. I minus del psi squared over 2m plus phi star psi psi. Okay. The equation motion for this guy, pulling out the psi dagger, is just the Schrödinger equation. Right? Let's ignore the interaction for the moment. It's just dt psi, dt psi minus del squared psi on 2m equals 0. Okay, so the Schrödinger equation has a nice series of properties. First off, it's clearly rotationally invariant, it's translationally invariant, it's time translationally invariant, the standard sort of kinematic invariances. But there's also a nice scaling law, which is that if x goes to lambda x and t goes to lambda squared t, then lambda scales out of the equation. Okay? So this is a scaling equation, a scaling symmetry of the system, where time is scaling asymmetrically with space. Fine. So somewhat less obviously, it respects a set of other symmetries. I'll call this the dilatation symmetry, which maps x to lambda x and t to lambda squared t. It also respects a symmetry generated by n, where n is the number operator, psi dagger psi. The symmetry generated by psi dagger psi is commutes with everything. It's all the operators in here. And most non-trivially, the operator C that maps x to x over 1 plus ct, and t to, whoops, maps x to, and t to t over 1 plus ct, is also a symmetry of this theory.
Why do potential commute with the number of
flow? Sorry?
Why do potential commute with the number of flow?
Let's focus on the free theory for the moment.
Okay.
So I'm just looking at the Schrodinger equation itself. Okay. So the symmetries of the Schrodinger equation are these. The fact that it commutes, so it doesn't commute with this operator, but at the critical point it turns out it does commute, which is a sort of spectacular fact. As you run this theory, a kinetic term gets generated phi, theory becomes considerably more interesting, but that's a story I don't want to get into. I just want to focus on the Schrodinger equation. So what are the symmetries of the Schrodinger equation? They're the obvious ones, plus this dilatation, plus this number operator jet symmetry, plus this special conformal transformation. So this is the analog of, in AES, the special conformal symmetry. So these guys form a group, and it's called, because it comes from the Schrodinger equation, the Schrodinger group. And it's one of several distinct kinds of non-relativistic conformal groups, but it's this one in particular, and so I'll be focusing on this for today. There's a lot you can say about other versions of non-relativistic conformal groups, but this is a particular kind, what I want to study. And the operators, the generators are just, again, the momenta, the rotations, the Hamiltonian, the time translation generator, the non-relativistic boosts, or Galilean boosts, the number operator, the dilatation operator, and the special conformal generators. Okay. More generally, there is a one-parameter family of similar conformal groups. Well, let me come back to that. So what are the non-trivial commutators? Well, the non-trivial commutators are the familiar ones. Rotation with a rotation gives you a rotation. Rotation on momentum gives you momentum. Rotation on a boost gives you a boost. H, the time translation on the boost, gives you momentum. Okay, so far, so good. P with K. So this one's a little different from familiar. It's I times 2, oh, sorry. This is 0 for the moment. And finally, the dilatation operator has commutation relations with H. They're equal to 2i H. Dilatation with momentum is just IV. So this is just this statement. This is the one before it. And the dilatation operator on K is equal to minus I K. Okay. So all the other commutators are trivial. There's a generalization of this, which comes with a parameter Z. So I'll often write it just SEH Z, where what changes here is we get a Z here. We get a 1 here, IP. And here we get I times 1 minus C. Okay. So this would have been, so if K is equal to 2, then this is exactly what we had written down a moment ago. The last commutator that changes is here. It's I times 2 minus Z, N. Okay. So what does the 2 correspond to, or the Z correspond to? Well, D with H is ZH. H is the generator of time translation, so the dilatation goes as m to the Z. Okay? So in general, what is this scaling relation really telling us?
Z commutes with everything?
Z is an integer. Or, sorry, Z is a number. It's a real number. So, yeah, it commutes with everything. It's a C number.
And also, what does n, how does n commute with the others?
It commutes with everyone except for the dilatation operator, D with N, sorry, I should have written this down, D with N goes as 2 minus z?
Yep,
2 minus z. And okay, so z equals 2, this vanishes, and this vanishes. So n becomes purely central. So z equals 2 is very special because n vanishes. Notice that I didn't write down the c commutators here. The c is only a symmetry if z is equal to 2. Okay, so we've got this one parameter family of conformal groups labeled by z. Z equals 2 is very special. It's the symmetry of the Schrödinger equation. So it's the familiar Galilean theory. It also has an enhanced symmetry. It's got a special conformal generator, and it has a central operator, n. There's a center to it, central extension. So if z equals 2, we also have the special conformal generator, which I'll just write down the commutators here for fun. D with c is equal to minus 2ic, and h with c is equal to minus I. So that should look familiar because it's just like in the relativistic conformal group.
What's the dimension of the subject one?
It depends on the number of spatial dimensions, but it's the same as the spatial Galilei dimension plus these two or three operators, depending on whether z equals 2 or not. If z equals 2, it's a Galilei group plus 2, or plus 3, and if z is not equal to 2, it's Galilei group plus 3.
Mm-hmm. Does it coincide with any of the known Lagrangians? I guess it's non-compact, right?
Yeah, it's non-compact because of H, right? That's right.
Does it coincide with any of the non-compact algebras?
I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. This algebra has been known for a very long time. So it's not one of the classical algebras.
Mm-hmm.
So it's its own. Well, sorry?
It's one of a well-known list of kinematical.
Exactly. It's one of a well-known list. It's not one of the classical mathematical classifications, but that's because people didn't waste their time with the non-compact special conform. I mean, it wasn't something that came up. So, but it's been known for a very long time, like much longer than I'm. Okay, and finally, just from the structure of, so let's just focus. I'll focus on z equals 2, where sort of life is easiest. In that case, in exactly the same way, so this is in a beautiful paper by Nishida and Song. Song, the condensed matter guy, Nishida, the liminal guy between CFD and, or condensed matter and string theory now. Very impressive physicist. I recommend his papers to you strongly. So Nishida and Song did the same thing with non-relativistic CFTs that has been long ago done for conformal field theories, organized it in terms of the primary operators and descendants, and studied the conditions from conformal symmetry on corresponding correlation functions and OPEs. And it's exactly what you'd expect from a familiar CFT. So every operator is labeled by an eigenvalue for the dilatation operator and also for the N operator. So again, in the fermions of unitarity, to keep intuition, I want to keep this fermion theory. N is just the fermion number. So L is just an integer denoting the number. Okay, that's the intuition I want you to keep here in mind. So in the sort of pipe dream of the full lithium system, L is just the number of lithium. Okay.
For arbitrary Z, can you write down the random or?
That's a good question. I mean, you can do the sort of silly thing of Z, but you know that's not a particularly well-defined thing, right? So I don't know of good Lagrangians that you know that are the conformal fixed points, but that shouldn't surprise you. It's a very special thing that Z equals 2, you know, admits a nice simple description.
How about if Z equals 4?
Z equals 4 has some nice properties. So let me not go into it, because I don't know enough about it to be clear. But Z equals 4 has some interesting properties.
Z equals
integer is much better. Yeah, exactly. Sort of on a superficial level, looks much better than Z not an integer. But let me complain about that a little bit and tell you why you shouldn't really care all that much. What is the physics of Z? What is Z really telling you? Z is telling you the dispersion relation, right? It's saying that omega goes like k to Z. And in lots of physical systems, at least in various regimes, and in lots of critical systems, this is just some stupid number, some scaling convention. So hence, Z gets the name of the dynamical exponent, because in general, the dynamics determine what Z is, and it's in general not an integer. Right? So for example, in graphene, this is an interesting question. So in graphene, just single flavor graphene, it's one. And that turns out to be protected from renormalization. There are all sorts of beautiful facts about it. But for multi-species models of graphene, where, you know, relativistic fermion, it gets corrected away from one to being a non-integer. Right? So, and that's understood very, very, very explicitly using classical techniques. So there are lots of systems. So, you know, multiple flavor graphene is like taking two sheets. So that's a very physical thing to do. Z not equal to an integer should not frighten you.
Did you
have
thesis in that? Is it exactly conformal or just classical?
Which exactly conformal, sorry?
Where
you mean, so I'm not exactly sure. So there's the toy model, which is exactly conformal, and then there is the system of fermions of the unitarity, and that's believed to be conformal from all observations. Yeah, it's exactly conformal. You can tune it to an exactly conformal point. So you can study it in various ways. There's a large N model. There's a epsilon expansion description, such as Evan Nikolic. There are many ways to study it. It's definitely conformal. There's a critical point where it's conformal. Okay. So what's the basic gig here for gauge gravity duality?
What was the point about this high star, high sky thing that you wrote?
Sorry?
Were you going to say something about this interacting term as well?
No, this is just to say that for a critical value of this coefficient, this becomes a conformal field theory. And you can show that. And that the free version is the Schrodinger equation. That was all that was about. So the basic gig then is, so recall from ADS-CFT that the conformal group in z plus 1, where little d will always be for me the number of spatial dimensions, is equal to the isometry group of some spacetime. We call the spacetime x. Okay. So for example, in the ADS, when the conformal group is equal to s of d, comma 2, then let me just write the ADS group. It's the ADS group. What's the spacetime? It's the ADS spacetime. Right? It's the spacetime that has this conformal group as its isometric group. So here, what are we going to do? Well, we want the non-relativistic conformal group. And this is going to be the Schrodinger group. We're just going to take this one. There are others that we choose, but it's Schrodinger. And this is going to be dual to some. That we'd like to find a spacetime which realizes this conformal group as its isometric group. So I'm going to call that spacetime the Schrodinger spacetime, again with some parameter z. So first off, before I write down what the metric is, what properties do we need to satisfy? Well, in the ADS case, the dilatation operator is geometrized as the generator for translations in the radial direction. Radius is the scale. In the Schrodinger case, we also have a central, z is doing to be central, but we have a number operator. And that number operator is going to be geometrized, again, as some generator of the translation or symmetry in the ball. And what do we know about it? First off, n is gapped, right? You have one massive object, or two, or three, but you don't have a continuous number. So this is going to be a translation operator along the compact direction. And secondly, it's gapped with uniform spacing and levels. Right? You have one lithium atom, or two lithium atoms, or three, not one, two and a half, six. So this is going to be a translation operator on a circle. And we should just expect that. We should expect that it looks something like a translation operator on a circle. OK? So we can't just, at this point, we can just write down a solution.
The statement you made was true for counting lithium atoms, and that's an interesting system. But
right.
At the end of the day, in some sense, you're just exploring.
That's right.
Holography, and so
exactly.
Would it make sense to consider a holographic system where that's not
Absolutely, it would. Absolutely. I'm looking for the, I'm sorry, I should have said this. You're absolutely right. I'm looking just for the simplest possible interpretation of the algebra I see in front of me. But in general, if I'm not trying to match to a system that has uniform gaps, then there's no reason for it to be a circle. I do expect it to be gapped. That's important. But in an interacting theory, there's no real reason that the gap has to be uniform. So absolutely, the geometry could be more interesting. Yeah. Let me also just say that we have solutions where it's more general than this. There exist solutions that are more general than this. They correspond to slightly different groups because you mean slightly different things by the operators, but yeah, such things certainly exist.
So this idea of being gapped, right? So maybe I would expect you have some kind of semi-classical pure gravity description when n is very large. So I guess I'm asking whether the supergravity limit effect will force you
excellent.
To be complexified.
Excellent question. Let me start by asking about systems where the number operator has zero vacuum expectation value. So I'm interested in the vacuum of the conformal field theory. Okay. Then let's ask later about turning on condensates. The easiest first thing to do is to turn on the empty vacuum. So let's look for that. And then this is an excellent question, but let me come back to it.
Do you think it would be sort of interesting if there an algebra that's not an N?
That doesn't have n? Yeah, that would be great. And in particular, from the Schrodinger algebra, if you don't have n, then you also don't have c. Not c.
Where is the computational relation I want?
Let me just say that so there are many variants of the non-relativistic conformal group. Sort of the most obvious that you know well is the Lipschitz analog where you get rid of k, right? If you get rid of boost, then you also get rid of n. You have neither k nor n. I don't know about getting rid of n. I mean, it's like a central extension, so you could ask about the unextended version. That's a completely reasonable question. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
You want to be more general, actually. I mean, there is no reason that you have a bulk metric. So there are examples of
absolutely
of non-relativistic CFTs that go up to a string field that has no space time.
Interpretation. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So that's exactly right. So this is very much in the spirit of Rob's question. Let me just say that I'm looking for the first things we can write down. So the easiest thing to do would be to find a gravity that's nice and metric and has the simplest structure possible. It's certainly not the most general. I'm in no way arguing that this is the only kind of thing that could be dual to a non-relativistic conformal field theory. I just want to start building examples. So the game at the end of the day is going to be indeed to build as general and interesting examples that have nice and interesting phenomenon as possible.
So you've geometrized this and you've got the circle direction. You want to dissociate that, maybe to motivate things, you went back to the idea of lithium atoms and counting lithium.
Right.
If I've got sort of a geometric picture, though, and I'm thinking of excitations,
yeah.
If n is, 561,
yeah.
It could be that I have 561 excitations with momentum 1.
Yep.
Or you could have any combination with lots of, and so there's,
absolutely.
It seems a very different system in that there are lots of species in this one, whereas the lithium
graph
had one thing you could add.
This, yeah, good. So that's right. So let's distinguish two things. Let's distinguish having many exit. Well, here's what I want to organize. I want to organize this I want to study the vacuum of the theory, and then we can ask questions about correlation functions in this theory in terms of correlation functions and primary operators, which are labeled by some del and some eigenvalue L of n. For that purpose, it's going to be sufficient to do what I'm about to do. Let me come back after we build the geometry, and you'll see, it'll be more obvious why I'm doing what I'm doing. So in particular, here's one way to make a non-relativistic system is to take the light cone system. Right? If you study a system in light cone, then it looks non-relativistic
If you interpret one of the Lycon directions as time, one of the Lycon directions is as a spatial direction. So let's look at AES and Lycon, just as an intuition. Okay. So the metric now is, let's say, dt, dc, minus 2, plus d, the remaining spatial direction squared, plus dr squared over r squared. I haven't done anything, I'm just going to like. So remember how the various operators act. So the rotations and translations are pretty obvious. The rotations and translations and everything are pretty obvious. One very important operator is the dilatation operator, which maps x to lambda x, r to lambda r, t, and the other spatial direction c to lambda themselves. And then there's the r squared downstairs, which cancels off all the times. Right? So this isn't very important to the dilatation action. D maps r to lambda r, and x t to lambda x and t. Okay? But it's also invariant under the following, when you write x to lambda x, t to lambda t, and c to lambda c. It's also invariant under the following, lambda squared and constant. Just happens to be true. It's a formally true thing. So on the other hand, there's an additional term I can write down that's invariant under this symmetry that I couldn't write down before. Minus dt squared over r to the fourth. And just for fun, I'm going to put a coefficient here. It is just some constant. Okay. So this is now invariant under this anisotropic scaling symmetry, but not under the original scaling symmetry. Does everybody agree with that? And if in general I make this 2z, and I put here lambda to the z and lambda to the 2 minus z, then this is again invariant. Okay? So this is a nice beast. It's no longer ADS and Lycon, it's a different geometry. And in particular, the asymptotic geometry is very different. As we go to the boundary, r goes to 0, the dt term dominates quadratically. Okay. So it's a different space time, it's got a different asymptotic geometry. So this is the Schrödinger space time with dynamical exponent z.
That happens only if z is greater than 1.
Yeah, that happens only if z is greater than 1. But if z is less than 1, then it also drops out and becomes like an ADS, but at the horizon, it dominates. It's the horizon where r is getting large, that one dominates. So the asymptotic geometry on either the boundary or the horizon is being rather dramatically changed. Okay. So what are the operators here? Well, so that's the dilatation operator. We can also identify the boost. Well, let me start with the number operator. Number operator is dvc. And making a gap suggests that we make C compact, which is a little bit subtle because C is like cone direction here. GCT is 0. So this is sort of like a DLC cube. And as a consequence, you have to worry about appearance of singularities, common singularities. There's also the Galilean boost generators, which map X to X minus VT and C to C plus 1 half 2 V dot X, V dot X plus or minus V squared T upon 2. Okay, so it acts in a rather non-trivial way. And the special conformal generators also similarly transform somewhat more messily than they do in the ADS case, but it's again some simple thing. So this is in fact invariant under the full set of isometries. It's relatively easy to check that defining as such the generators, they form the right algebra. So the space term realizes the symmetry group faithfully as an isometric group. So good. So things to note: one is to make n gap, we need to make C compact. In this
sort of simple case, it's easiest to just make it a circle, a DLCQ circle. You could do something more interesting, but for this metric, it's the simplest thing.
Here's the simple unit.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this parameter? It doesn't seem to be.
If xi, if you make good, so this is excellent question. If xi is periodic and n is gamma, then this is broken. Then the boosts are broken too. Well, they're broken. So the spacetime it faithfully reproduces the conformal group if the n operator is not gamma. It's a strange. So this is one of the strange properties of the system.
It doesn't sound very physical.
Sorry. No, it doesn't sound very physical. It sounds very unphysical. And look, and also, if you make C compact, there's a conical singularity. It's at the horizon. It sounds very bad, right? If you turn on a finite temperature, though, so this is a nice thing. If you turn on a finite temperature, two nice things happen. First, look, you've broken boosting rates already, right? Just by turning on the finite temperature, you've broken. But you've broken it by turning on a temperature. That's a relatively familiar way to break. That's not a scary way to break conformal symmetry. The other important thing that does is it builds a horizon which shields you from the singularity, from the conical singularity. The conical singularity is now behind the horizon. This is just like in the null singularity case, or in the null orbifold case. In the null orbifold, you're worried because you've got this rather horrible singularity, but if you throw a little bit of stress energy tensor in, or stress energy in, it falls over, you get a horizon, and you're screened from the singularity by a horizon, which is a nice state of affairs. And the same thing happens here. When you turn on any temperature, you're screened from this conical singularity if you stay outside the horizon.
But the temperature breaks the symmetry spontaneously.
Yes.
But here, you're saying that the compactified is just not there.
Absolutely. And this is the analogy I'm drawing here is to this pizza wedge picture of quantum critical point controlling the physics of finite temperature even away from the strict critical point. So in order to get the kind of geometry we want, you have to explicitly break the conformal symmetry. But at finite temperature, it's still behaving as if it's the finite temperature conformal field theory. I can't give you more satisfying answer than that because I just don't have one. This is the best people have been able to build so far.
Why do you keep beta?
Good. Okay, so you might worry that beta can scale away, right? Because if I take t to 1 upon delta t and c to delta c, then beta shifts to beta upon delta. And if I take delta large, beta just goes to 0. So I can set beta to anything I want. On the other hand, if xi is periodic, then this changes the periodicity of xi. So beta L xi is invariant.
Okay.
So there is one physical parameter, which is a combination of beta and L xi. That's invariant under any coordinate transformations. So rather than worry about L xi, I'm just maintaining beta. Mm-hmm. If you want to rescale beta, I'll just rescale L xi to keep beta whatever it was, to keep the physical value invariant. That's why I'm keeping beta.
Okay.
So this went much slower than I intended. So there are many things that you can say about the correspondence. In particular, just given this geometry, you can ask, well, is there the usual ADS-CFT map between bulk fields and boundary operators? In particular, if the bulk field has a radial dependence near the boundary that goes like R to the delta, then this should couple to an operator O with dimension delta. And you could ask whether doing this reproduces things like the OBE structure, the sum rules on the dimensions of OBEs for the boundary operators, and the answer is yes. So the kinematics all works out just fine. We do that in our paper, Solomon and McGreevy and Balsubonin pointed that out for scalars in the first papers on this. And then you can walk through the construction of the generating functional on the boundary. Here are the boundary values of my fields. In terms of the bulk calculation, the integral over the boundary of d plus 2 now, because it's r and c. R and T, in the bulk plus C, we're getting rid of R by going to the boundary. So that's spatial dimensions and C and T. So D equals 2X, phi X, DR phi X, evaluated near the boundary. And the correlation, let me just skip the calculation, but the correlation functions work through just as you'd expect.
You mean boundary in the literal sense? Because I mean, I thought you said the boundary is one-dimensional.
Yeah, well, okay, good. I mean boundary in the usual sense. And one of the basic confusions in this particular story is the details of plot. Because that's from the power bar. But there's an interesting and important fact about this that it's easier to follow. Look at the inverse metric. The inverse metric doesn't have two t components, or it doesn't have a h upper tt. It has an h upper, so this is zero, it has an h upper xc.
Okay.
And an h upper tc. Right? So this tells you that in the equation of motion, you get a single time derivative. So in the equation of motion, you get a dt dxc phi. So if we expand in modes in the xc direction, this is just an L dt phi L. Okay. And we get plus L squared phi Ls. But we don't have anything like a true time derivative term. So this term, this funny scaling, when you look at the equations of motion, for example, for scalar fluctuations, goes into a funny scaling for this term, which is like the mass term, because this comes with a g xc xc, which is just 1 upon gtt. So this is getting very, very large. That means the inverse g xc xc is getting very, very small in some meaning. And in the equation of motion, the equation, which is, you know, what you need, you look at the on-shell action for solutions to the equation of motion, the solutions to the equation of motion all behave perfectly fine. So evaluating this action at the naive boundary, r goes to epsilon, is perfectly fine. Where this comes to bite you in the butt, this arc exploding, is in trying to calculate the renormalized boundary stress constant. And there some things get confusing. In particular, the components t, xc, xc, and t, xc, t turn out to be rather badly behaved. So these can't be renormalized. No, they can't be renormalized in the usual sense. But here's the nice thing. Neither of these appears in the calculation of, for example, any of the thermodynamic potentials on the boundary. The thermodynamic potentials are in T and X. So the relevant components of the stress tensor are T upper T lower T upper T lower X, TXX, right? Those are the relevant bits. These guys don't appear in the boundary. This is an auxiliary, it's just like R. It's an auxiliary direction that we've introduced for bookkeeping. We don't ask about TRR when we're talking about the boundary theory. That's not part of the physics of the boundary theory. That's bookkeeping. It's the same sort of thing here. And it's particularly nice that it works, that the equation of motion works out just precisely so that this pathology of the scaling towards the boundary falls out when you calculate all the, you know, the flux coefficients in here to calculate the viscosity or whatever correlations you want. And this happens always in any equation of motion precisely because this one is zero and this one is going to zero.
Are you saying that will not be zero? I can see that that's not the problem if I look at, say, one-point correlation function. Right. If I look at a higher point correlation function of normal components of the stress energy, then I might suspect that it can be wrong.
Yeah, so I don't have an argument in general, but for all the 1 and 2 point functions and for any of the stress tensor components, there's no problem. Beyond that, it's possible that something arises. I haven't studied that question. The reason I haven't worried about higher point functions is that while I can give this argument that the things that you physically you'd expect to be well behaved, the energy density on the boundary, the momentum density on the boundary, are well behaved, the fact that this, you know, who is xc, right? Why should txcx be divergent? There should be a good renormalization, boundary renormalization definition where nothing diverges, right? I mean, I would have thought that would be an important property of the theory. Here we have nothing physical diverges, but that's not very satisfying. So this is already confusing.
But when it's just, I guess, something that Jamel is alluding to, and I think it's right. See, so when we talk about renormalizability, you think in the context of renormalizability of state plus one dimensional, because the theory is not state plus one dimensional, the union needs just one dimensional.
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by it. So let me problem. So say you're a non-relativistic conformal field theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, just to pick an example. I live in 2 plus 1, I'm conformal, I'm non-relativist. If I have a gravity description, if I have a gravity description where the conformal group is the isometric group, it realizes as a dimension the eigenspace, the carrying space for the number operator. right? So invariably, I have these two dimensions. But they're not physical. The boundary, that the space that I live in is not a one-dimensional space, right? So the relevant geometry for this question is not a one-dimensional space. Now, there's a formal sense here in which the boundary is one-dimensional. But if you look at the equation of motion, that's not the relevant question for boundary fluctuations of the bulk modes, because equation of motion doesn't have that singularity. The equation of motion for scalars, and indeed for p-form fields, doesn't have that pathology. So it's a strange version of holography that we don't understand, but where, I mean, I
agree with you, this it's hard to interpret this side coordinate.
So that remains very much sort of mysterious. One thing I would quickly say is that if you calculate correlation functions in these theories, so if you calculate correlation functions in these theories, then you get really nicely, you know, ratios of gamma functions and a delta, a total dimension conserving delta function, and then you get e to the minus l squared upon 2 t or p. Notice that this is giving you, this is just the legacy of, sorry, z, that kid is z, of the dynamical scaling of z. So it works out, it comes out in all the places it should. The kinematics all work out like this. So, okay, Corey came over. So I'll just very, very quickly say so what have we gone through? So I hope you believe that we can at least begin to start applying these. There's this nice map between a geometry and the conformal group, which allows you to pose the duality. Because there are two parameters for every parallel primary, there are two holographic dimensions, which leads to a plethora of problems, this is probably obvious. Lots of examples I didn't tell you about. So far, all I've done is I've written down some candidate geometry. But you can find this geometry through a series of different solution-generating techniques inside string theory. So you can find the string theory that you have. You can find it in string theory by using some series of solution-generating techniques, for example, the Garfinkel-Vespucci. Let me just call it GV. If you have a metric that has a null isometry, this is very cute. D squared is equal to du dv plus ds squared on some manifold m. Then, and this subset, this is a solution, okay, with maybe some matter content, then you can add plus du squared, where A is a harmonic on M with some eigenvalue, where the details of this graphification determine what value this harmonic has to have, what eigenvalue this harmonic has to have. So that's sort of a beautiful fact, and it depends crucially on these being U and V being null. So in particular, if you take ADS, where this is over R squared, the R squared, what's the R squared, you can do exactly the same thing, R to some number, where the number and alpha depend on exactly what M is. So different spherical harmonics on M correspond to different deformations that you're allowed to do by this null. So that's pretty cool. This is a beautiful old technique. And you can use this to, for example, build something that looks like this, R to the fourth. So if we have the ADS 5 of S5, then you pick some, it turns out this has to be 12, just from dimension counting. So if you pick some L equals 2 spherical harmonic, it indeed has L times L plus 4 is 12 for L equals 2. So if you pick an L equals 4 spherical harmonic, you get this correction where Z is equal to 2. And okay, that's a fine solution. And there are 20 L equals 2 spherical harmonics on the spheres. That's nice. So this was figured out by Hartnell and Yoshida. Annoyingly, this only works at zero temperature, right? You need a null isometry. So at finite temperature, this doesn't work for you. So there's this beautiful other construction called the null-null twist. This is a very fancy way of doing something analogous to the Penrose limit. In the Penrose limit, you say, okay, I've got this geometry, and I want to focus on a particular geodesic in the geometry. So you pick coordinates that make that geodesic obvious, and some parameter that controls the distance away from that geodesic, and I just take a limit where I hold all the coordinates fixed and scale that parameter so that I just focus in on the region right around the GB. Okay. There are other solution generating techniques where you pick some series of coordinate transformations and dualities and whatnot, just so that you isolate some part of the geometry. So there's one called the Melvin twist, which won't even describe. But the Melvin twist allows you to build very similar facts you can build.
So before that,
it's
not just solution generating techniques, can you give it an interpretation of focusing in some specific harmonic?
That's right. I just want to gloss over that for a moment. But that's where it comes from. That's where the solution generating technique is where these solutions come from. But there are various ways to do that.
Schwann solution also suffers from having singularity.
Yes, it also has it has a variety of topologies. So in particular, so let me come back to it in just a second. So there are many other ways to construct these, including ways with horizons. So you can construct these families with finite temperature using this sort of Melvin machine. So at the end of the day, you can build lots and lots of geometries that are asymptotically Schrödinger, or some modification of Schrödinger. But they have, in general, they have a couple of pathologies, which no one at the moment knows how to, at least to my knowledge, no one knows how to explain.
Before we go into pathologies of this particular class, by lots, you mean lots, which are, first of all, d equals 3, right? Because minus 2 dimensions. So my question is,
good.
Are we talking about anything other than z equals 2 and anything other than d equals 2 plus 1?
Yes, we are. So embedded in string theory, we have z equals 2 and z equals integers away from 2.
Okay.
Or sorry, non-integers away from 2. Things down by like 1 over n squared, where n is some large integer.
Okay, so that's higher derivative construction.
Higher derivative,
right.
And if you just let go of the string theory construction and you just ask for finite temperature geometries that are in other dimensions, you could also.
I'm sure as a phenomenology we can do, but
yeah, exactly.
2 plus 1, can we do anything other than 2 plus 1?
Well, the thing about 2 plus 1 is that it's the same thing as with why do we use 3 brains all day? Why are we always focusing on 3 brains? And
you started with a beautiful story of Lysia Mantos, which we mean 3 plus 1.
Yeah, absolutely. But let me come back to the ADS-CFT case. In ADS-CFT, 3 brains are particularly nice because the dilaton's flat. Here it's the same game. You get something that's strictly conformal in the stupidest possible way by starting with something that has a flat dilaton. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can do similar things in ADS-4 cross S7, for example, or ADS-7 cross S7. Four. You can start with 2 brains or 5 brains in M theory, and you can start asking about toroidally compactifying, but then you start getting into dilatons again once you start compactifying further. So you're limited by that constraint. We don't have a good description of a 3-dimensional.
The idea is bad because you need to heat it up in order to make sense, and in that case, you're back to little strings, which
exactly.
You heat up.
Exactly. So at the moment, embedded within string theory, we don't have any way to get to the 3-dimensional case.
But it's good that you're saying, but okay, so within the supergravity,
you
cannot get past that equal.
No. So z is much more flexible. So z by tuning the compact. So the pathologies you're referring to in the Hartnell and Yoshida compactifications, that's a quirk of the way they built them. They're similar but different ones that don't suffer from those pathologies, the instabilities. I can talk to you about them. You don't build them in exactly the same way, but whatever. You can build ones that don't have those pathologies. And for those, you can make z something that depends on m, on the compactification manifold, and on the particular choice of spherical harmonics you write down. It's a string construction. It's a string construction with very general z. You can also study quantum corrections, and those quantum corrections, and it's much more general z. There are no restrictions on it.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. So I think that's pretty much what I wanted to say. Modulo the fact that I got through half of what I wanted to say. I'll just say that quantum effects are tractable, at least to some degree. We can study hair curvature effects and map them to boundary effects. Which is at least a step in the right direction. As should be obvious at this point, this is enormously open territory. Right? There's very little that we know rigorously. On the other hand, there's an awful lot that works out kind of surprisingly well when you go through the mechanics of actually computing everything. It's pretty non-trivial that things work out very nicely. So
I think there's a lot of I think there's a lot of motivation to think further about these systems, and invite you all to do so.
So the standard is roughly what the field theories are that correspond to.
Good. So
they are not this lithium atoms, right?
No. They're not even close to lithium atoms. That's right. So if, just like in ABS CFT, we have some stupid large n instances, right? So if the ones that we where we start in string theory, so we can figure out what the boundary theory is, there's some stupid large n limit involved. So we don't know how to get around that. Okay, so that's one problem. Leaving aside that one problem, which that sort of one huge problem, we have other problems, which is there are two different ways you can deduce. So in these solution generating techniques, one of the nice features of these solution generating techniques is that you can map them into the string theory as a series of machinations and strings machination. That means you can lift them to actions on the D rings that are building the geometry. That means you can lift them to actions on the world volume theory. So you can do the machinations not to the metric, but also to the world volume theory. So at the end of the day, you get some limit of the world volume theory, some deformation of the original world volume theory. So you can figure out what the dual field theory is. And here's the problem. I didn't describe this, but there's a limiting process in this nullvanizing process that we use to get the finite temperature solutions. And there's more than one way. There's an order of limits issue. There are two different ways you can take the order of limits. And one way gives you theories that Knorr and other people studied, you know, almost a decade ago, these dipole theories, null dipole theories, which are great, but they have all sorts of non-local structure. There's a star product. It's a complicated machine. The other way gives you something extremely simple, which is basically a DLCQ. We've compactified this C direction. So it's basically a DLCQ, but instead of demanding periodicity under for every field under C, C plus L is equal to by C, which is what you do in a DLCQ, here, where did this beta parameter come from? Well, it comes in the following way. E to the beta times a particular R current. And the particular solution we got here depends on exactly what solution generating we use, what twist we do in the Nullvanizing, if you're familiar with that. And so you're not requiring that the fields are periodic on the DLCQ circle. You're requiring that they're periodic up to some action by the SO6R symmetry, the SU4R symmetry. Okay? So, for example, the vectors are just DLCQ. And the scalars are DLCQ'd, but they get a moding shift, which is proportional to beta times their R charge, right? Which is one. So this is very different from the dipole theory. Lagrangian is local, or at least it looks local because you know you've got a zero mode for the transverse photons, which is the standard problem in DLCQ. But it looks very different from the dipole theory. Now, which order of limits corresponds to this geometry? So we don't know. And we also don't even know if they're actually inequivalent theories. They look inequivalent, but they both respect the non-relativistic conformal curve. And I have no way of, at the moment, I have no way of saying that they're explicitly different. There's nothing I've been able to compute that is different. Now, it's hard to compute things in either of these presentations. So there are very few things where you can really test this. So here's an interesting question to which I don't think anyone knows the answer. Are these two theories different? Is the dipole theory and the beta DLCQ in an null direction, are they different? We don't know.
Can you t-dualize the C direction?
Yes, you can t-dualize the C. You can also t-dualize the R current direction. And interesting things happen, which we can talk about afterwards. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a sort of interesting. I mean, you can see what's gonna happen with the C direction. It gets very pathological. But if you work at finite temperature, it's not pathological. Everything's perfectly smooth. The zero temperature limit of that though is rather badly behaved. I don't know how to do that in terms of the boundary theory, but it's an excellent question. We can talk about it afterwards. I've gone way over for which I was really.
So as far as this condensed limited systems are concerned, none of them has this n parameter, which you have in the gravity study.
No, they all have the n parameter. Well, I think we're. Oh, you mean none of them have the? Sorry, none of them have the n. No, there are toy models that do, but none that are experimentally realized in the lab. There are weak modifications of that. The lithium atom system, you can have them spin polarized. So you can have, you know, some population up, some population down. So there are two species. So there are NS2. exactly. Not very useful. There are theoretical toy models. Sasha and Nikolic have a beautiful analysis of large NRL. So do Sonnen and Nishida and Sonnen and Son and someone else have some beautiful analysis of large N versions of several of these theories, where they calculate large N corrections, for example, to the dynamical exponent and get something that goes like one.
So they couple into the engagement.
No, it's just large N flavor. So they're just explaining the flavor structure. They're not studying gauge theories.
That's
my before that, since I've gone so far over, could I just finish and then we can discuss
additional questions afterwards?
Phil's question.
Okay, well, let's come back to that effort. So thank you very much. So that way people can leave. Yeah.
The question that I asked is concern number n.
Yes.
Like the number of operators, we cannot do back calculation in the boundary.
Yes.
But in the back, we can actually calculation in just a momentum in the same direction and the opposite momentum.
Yes.
What is calculation in the bulk corresponding to the bulk?
As you, so one way to understand, so it's easiest to understand this at the finite temperature metric, which I haven't written down, but you, intuitively here's what the bulk geometry looks like. The bulk geometry at finite temperatures, you've got a horizon region, which is basically ADS, and pick some direction. There's a tau direction, a time-like direction, and a y direction, so strictly time-like and strictly space-like. And as you move radially outward, they rotate, so they become null. Okay, those directions become null. So once you get out, so let's say we make an ending particle and a particle. Once we run out to the boundary, one has positive p plus, one has negative p plus. Okay. So I don't know if I'm doing a good job of drawing this picture, but if you just lived in a DLCQ geometry, then the light cone momentum is effectively a super selection thing, right? If you have, different units of light from momentum, you're separated from the other moments. There's a momentum conserving delta function. So here, if you have a particle in any particle in the boundary, or inside the bulk, as you get out to the boundary, they just correspond to different light cone momenta.
But in the boundary, they make sense.
Particle number on the boundary is not particle number in the bulk. Right, this is probably the easiest way to answer the question. So say you have particle number on the boundary, right? So where does that come from in the bulk? There's some mode, if you want to create particle number non-zero, there's some mode in the bulk whose non-normalizable mode is the coefficient of that boundary operator. But the modes of the field in the bulk are not the modes of the field on the boundary, right? So pair creation in the bulk is not the same as pair creation in the boundary. Okay. So I mean, that's the zeroth order answer to the question. They're different things. Then you can ask what happens if you take a particle and antiparticle pair and you take them out to the boundary. And then this is the question of whether, the time-like and the space-like components rotate as you go out to the boundary. So what you call the particle and antiparticle is different from what you call the particle and antiparticle at the boundary. Just, they're different things. This is best done in equations. Yeah,
I have something from the simpler ideas. So one of the things, so in ADS, if you basically know that we're kind of maybe on the right track, the reason is that there is a thermodynamics which kind of
yes.
helps to switch what is matches to that state. Yeah, I guess my question is there some kind of feature of these models on the gravity side that maps reasonably in the world part of people talking?
Okay, yeah, so good. Excellent. So there's the stupidest thing I can say in response is eta upon s. Okay, so eta upon s we can calculate here.
Yeah.
You're totally unshocked when I tell you that eta upon s is 1 upon 4 pi.
No.
You're surprised? Okay, so.
No, I'm not surprised.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's completely unsurprising. You should
yeah.
not display any surprise to discover that it's 1 upon 4 pi. And there are many reasons for this, one of which is that we got this geometry like a Penrose limit by focusing in on ADS.
We have Melvin's waste and Q.
Exactly. It's some stupid
link.
Exactly. So it's not really different. But here's the thing that should surprise you. Or I don't know if I should, but here's the thing that surprised me. So people do this experiment. Oh, and I should have said that. People have done this experiment with the lithium atom system. Which, look, this is not the lithium atom system, right? It's not even vaguely in the same universality class. It has the same conformal symmetry group. In a different number of dimensions,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just, it's a different system. Nonetheless, just like in the other strongly coupled systems that we've been able to describe using gravity, when they measure the viscosity, or how do they measure the viscosity? This is very cool. They take their little lithium cloud, they shoot a couple of lasers through it, use them like chopsticks, and get the thing spinning. So they've induced some shear, okay? So they've induced some shear, and they turn off the trap and watch it expand. And just like the Rick almond wedge, it expands, according to the hydrodynamics. The viscosity makes it
overcompensate for it, its own niche, for its shear. And from watching, literally by imaging the expanding cloud, you can back out, and very much the same and problematically as at Rick, you can back out the viscosity. And so when they calculate the viscosity, so far the best sort of public numbers are from Thomas, you get somewhere between A upon S, in somewhere between greater than 0.1 and less than 0.2.
Now, how does the entropy, how does the entropy itself, is it, come, so they must know what the entropy is.
Yes.
How does it scale?
So they're near conformal fixed points. So you know it scales as t cubed, right? So I mean, there's no other dimensional parameter.
So here the scaling is a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly.
So 8 over S, yeah. So 8 over S is not very.
Exactly. This is what I'm saying. 8 upon S is like the least sensitive probe in the system you can imagine. The one thing that's nice is that the physics is still taking us. It's it's not that far. I should say, by the way, new data is supposed to be coming out on Monday, so Thomas is going to be giving us a talk on Monday. So we'll see. Maybe it gets better. But this is getting very close to saturated. And this, the physics here is totally different from the physics at RIP, right? It's utterly different. How much more different could you get? I mean, you're non-relativistic, these are lithium atoms, they're micro-pelvic. This is incredibly far from quark oil fiber, and it's still coming close to saturating. So there's something sort of, I think it's still not trivial, but it's very close to trivial. Right. So apart from this, we don't really have other parameters we can compare. Right, like bulk viscosity, okay, lots of things vanish. That's just exactly. So there are all sorts of stupid things like that. We don't have a good non-trivial calculation.
These experiments, they are slow flow, right?
Yeah, very exactly. So you can really tell the hydrodynamics if
you can't.
Yeah. Well if you were very sophisticated, you might imagine you could. In practice it's totally intractable.
I mean, the additional high derivative
are huge. Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, it's very clean, right? So you can really. I mean, to give you some sense of how clean this is, how do you know you're in a superfluid phase? How do you know you're in a superfluid phase rather than just a very fluid phase? Right? And the answer is, if you spin the thing, you can see the red sublattice of vortices, and they can image that. Okay. So the accuracy with which they can literally watch the fluid flow is spectacular. That said, you're still in the totally high derivative regime. You're dominated by higher derivative operators.
So I'm going to abuse maybe some of the people, but I guess.
Actually, before you go, the hydro, how did they extract that number?
I don't know. I can't answer that exactly because I don't know. But the experiment is to the best of my knowledge.
But like when you go to RIC, you had to do a simulation of the hydro, and it's only relatively recently that they knew what to simulate.
I think this is part of the problem for the group at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Anyway, I think it's for Duke. It's they have the same problem figuring out how to extract from the hydrodynamics from the hydrodynamic expansion the viscosity is non-trivial to them too. They have the advantage that they can do really good imaging, right? They can slowly watch the thing expand and take a movie. But they have the disadvantage that time scales are much longer, and as a consequence, the coupling across the system is large. So,
how about central charges? So just now kind of purely theoretical, if I take this, is it beautifully graphical or quantitative, or non-relativistic CUP?
Right.
So how much is developed, say, the standard CFT here? What's the central charge? What are the classification principles? Like, there is A and C business.
Good.
What's the story here?
Okay, good. I can only give you a partial answer to that, but let me tell you a couple of salient features. The first is, we're not in T1+1, so we don't have anything like C controlling density states or anything. There's nothing beautiful for the central charges like there was in 2D. It's much more like in 4D, where we have A and C, and they're wonderful things, but they don't control the asymptotic growth of the density of states or anything like that. It would be nice, but we don't have that luxury. Good. In the z=2 case, anyway, N is central. And that's the only central operator. So it's a relatively simple. It's a relatively simple system. Beyond that, for the larger question of in a general system, I don't know that there's a classification. It was only very recently that this Schrödinger z=2
example was fully classified, fully, or I should say fully, that the representation theory of the conformal group was fully developed. This is Nishida and Son, which is a great paper, and I strongly recommend. So they really nailed it, right? They nailed down the z-equals theory, but that's one very special case. In general, I don't believe it's understood.
So you wrote down a very simple model, or a model that they studied and proven as conformal.
Right.
Can you, or do they know what the spectrum of operators is?
Yeah, they do. They.
And can you say something about it? I mean, does it look like your spectrum other than it has two labels?
No, it doesn't. No. It doesn't look at all like our system. On just like trivial zeroth order things, we have massless gauge bosons, you know, full stop. So the spectrum of the system looks very, very different.
How can you have a massless gauge boson?
Well, okay, this is the stupidity with DLCQ, right? So with DLCQ, you have this really frustrating situation where
That's how content told us that DLCQ should not be done naively. You should take a limit and blah, 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 and then you get something completely.
Yeah, exactly. So let me show you what happens here and why the situation is different.
Okay.
Here you can be naive about almost every mode except the vectors.
Yeah.
And the reason is because you have the e to the qr times the r current, right? So what this does is this changes the modem in L. So in the kinetic term, why is DLCQ a naively dangerous thing to do, at least if you do it straightforwardly? It's because in the kinetic term, you have a dt dc, and if I expand in modes, this just becomes L dt phi L. Now, if I look at the zero mode, the constant mode along the DLCQ circle, then there's no kinetic term, and this becomes a constraint, right? So on the other hand, when we have this modified DLCQ, L never has a zero mode. There's no solution which is constant. Right? So for all the fields with R charge, this becomes beta QR plus N, where N is the integer. Okay. So they're all gapped. And I should have been a little more careful about it here. It's L beta, which is the invariant, and it's QR. Good. Except for the one field in N equals 4, which doesn't carry an arbitrary, which is the vector. So for the vector, you have to treat the system rather differently. But what's the physics of that zero mode? The physics of that zero mode is a Gauss law constraint, right? You're in the DLCQ, and all that zero mode is telling you is that there's a Gauss law. There's still a Gauss law constraint. And we have that, and that's not present in the free fermion picture, right? So if you take the free fermion model, you work at some large N. So you free fermion model with some large N flavor structure, which people study. If you don't have a Gauss law constraint, you're going to get a totally different bit of physics, right? As is familiar from trace relations and ADS-CFT already. So the spectrum looks very different. We have bosons; they don't have any bosons. We have scalars; they don't have.
My point is, you want to study the aspect of this field different, right?
Yes.
You shouldn't do this.
I agree.
You should do something completely different. Cyber consent explained.
Yes.
You get something that. But for the M5 brain,
right.
Looks, you get quantum mechanics and instant models.
Right.
What does this have to do with quantification?
Yeah.
It's completely different.
Yes, I completely agree.
So have people done that for this?
No, they haven't. This is the stupid, idiotic, big, empty space right now. So something that needs to be done. There are many things that need to be done here. This is one of the things that badly needs to be done.
Related to
that,
I don't imagine that. Okay. We are on YLT. We didn't start it. Anybody who wants to leave can leave. Okay?
Yes. I'll turn it around. I won't be
afraid. Give the applause.